Okay, today is February 4th, 2014. This is the second interview with, do you go by Dave or David?
David.
Mm-hmm. David Ahrens, and we are here inside the City County building, inside the Madison Common Council suite of offices. My name's Troy Reeves. So David, we last left off chronologically at 2003, mm-hmm. And we just talked about that. So 2003 was just where we ended. It wasn't necessarily an end point or a changing point for you on campus.
No. But in terms of, I guess in 2005, I began working as a, functioning as a delegate to the Academic Staff Assembly. For our unit, which was the Cancer Center, and the Academic Staff Assembly is a body that's charged with, it's statutorily charged with developing and reviewing policies and procedures in employment policies and procedures in regard to academic staff. It reviews them, and it doesn't necessarily set those policies mm-hmm. and procedures. It's a review process and review and comment okay. on it.
Mm-hmm. How did you first find out about Academic Staff Assembly or ways to become involved as an academic?
I think it's
staff
part person. Of the orientation. You get, you know, different parts of it. It's a very, I think it's quite a low profile a group, probably within my unit. I think very few people had really heard of it. But you know, because of my background in employment relations, I was interested in that there is such a body mm-hmm. exists. So I contacted them, and they said, "Oh, please be a delegate. We haven't had a delegate from the Cancer Center for years." I began to attend those meetings and. It was as I thought, which was that it's, first of all, it's chaired by the provost. So it doesn't even have the autonomy, sort of being chaired by a member of its own body. Mm-hmm. It's chaired by an official of the administration. In terms of doing employment relations, because it's academic staff, there's such huge range of academic staff that you have. When I joined it, I was what's called a research program manager. I had hired and fired, and I was a program manager, and there were many people who were very senior. There are a lot of people who were assistant deans in the leadership of the group. So really, in terms of being it couldn't really function as an advocate for employment rights for most of the academic staff, because people want to exercise their managerial authority. So it's a very mixed bag of everybody who's research assistant. I forget the classifications now, but sort of the lowest lab rat, shall we say, to my position, which was the highest research administration, but research program manager 3. So it's basically it's for research programs that are more than $1 million. So that's quite a bit of latitude there. So the academic staff assembly reviewed fairly minor policies. I'd never, in the probably 4 or 5 years that I was a member of it, and I stayed as a member of it throughout UFAS and everything else, it never took a substantive critical view of an administrative policy. And this went all the way to the whole revision of the academic staff under the new human resource policies that took effect in, or almost took effect, and then were repealed in 2012. So I attempt to participate in that, and then in around 2007 or 8, I became interested in working with the union, because that is the United Faculty and Academic Staff, because in 2008 the faculty and academic staff won collective bargaining rights. I think I'd been a member earlier and then left because it seemed to be just have one issue, which was to get collective bargaining rights, and until that was going to happen, there was really not much that that organization can do other than work for collective bargaining rights. And as it was a, is a pretty expensive organization to be a member of. It's, they wanted 1% of your salary, 1% of your gross salary was the dues. So in terms of my ideological commitment, it wavered at that point. But once the collective bargaining rights were won, then it became a whole different story, which is now there's something to really do. And the whole question of collective bargaining on the campus, which had been going on for 80 years, now was past the point of discussion, and now was a point of reality, or not reality. You're either going to do it or not. And that was true for all faculty and academic staff. The collective bargaining bill was passed as an actual bill. Along with it, however, was a series of amendments to budget bills that, let me just say, in case you haven't gotten this from other people, the model that was going to be developed was there would be separate academic staff and faculty votes on each campus. It was not going to be either cross-campus, inter-campus, or inter-academic staff. So there were going to be all separate bargaining units. Each of those units, so academic staff and faculty, say on the Madison campus, could collectively, that is, not collectively, but they would both have to affirmatively vote yes to make one bargaining unit. So it looked to be a multiple bargaining units all across these many units, many different campuses. So there we were. And the second thing that happened was, and this turned out to be really momentous, was one of the budget bills included a provision that was called the, it's cumbersome language, unit clarification of the academic staff. Over the years, as new positions are created, and the university is always never destroying, but always creating new classifications and new positions, it's incumbent on the HR department to say, okay, here we have a seismic technologist, seismic technologist one, seismic technologist two, so, and so on. What bargaining unit should that person be in? Should that person be in an academic staff unit? Should that person be a technical staff that is represented by currently by a union? And if so, which union? So on. So hundreds of these things come forth. I mean, on a literally hundreds per year come forth. And the HR department puts them in these different boxes. Well, the unions have always contended that they're putting an awful lot of them in the academic staff box, which is not represented, and rarely are they put into one of their technical and clerical or scientist. AFT had a science professionals position, science professionals unit, and AFSCME had this clerical unit. It was called clerical technical, and then there was another union called the blue collar unit, which were people who do blue collar work, the sweepers and cleaners and non-skilled trades mechanics. So this was going on over years, and the AFSCME units were often crying that, you know, through attrition, their locals are getting smaller, while this academic staff unit has grown to over 8,000. Okay. And there were, you know, a lot of charts that, you know, showed this real up and sweeping curve. You know. So late in the budget process of the last budget of the Doyle era, entered an amendment that said basically that the unions can just petition for all of the people, any of the people they saw fit within the academic staff, and have them, and here's the word, accreted to their existing unit. Well, there's a process of unit clarification, and this is a study that I conducted when this came about. It's a process that can that happens in both private and public sector labor relations, and so in the public sector, you know, you have a county garage, and they hire a storekeeper. It's called a storekeeper. Is that person a management employee? Is that person a blue collar, white collar? What local union do they go to? And there's a different. If there's a difference of opinion, people would go to the WERC, and you'd have a short hearing on this. Person would describe their duties, and someone from the commission would say, put it in this box or put it in that box. And so I went through all of the unit clarification petitions ever conducted by the PERC in 10 years. And the average size of the units that were being clarified were two. Okay, it's usually one, two, three, four. Okay. Well, this was something where they were going to take about 4,000 people and assign them to a union without an election. And it's unheard of. I mean, in the private and public sector, it's simply unheard of. When you have a unit of that size, people vote. it should not just be an administrative process. And it's, I mean, in many different ways. I mean, it's anti-democratic and everything else. So a lot of people raised quite a stink about it. And Doyle said, well, he didn't mean for it to be that. I mean, I think just his democratic impulse, even though he wanted to do a favor for the unions after all those years, I think his democratic impulse was, well, of course, if you can have thousands of people who are in a union, they should vote to whether or not they want to join. Well, the unions didn't see it that way. The unions, in the immortal words of Marty Beale, said, I want what's mine. That was his quote in the paper. He thought that he had some legal, moral, some kind of right to just tell 1,500 people, you're now in our union, pay up. And for our purpose in UFAS, we saw it as, well, of course, it's undemocratic. And people would be furious. And after they were furious, they would vote the union out. And when I pointed out to some of the unions that you're about to accrue so many people and they're going to be so pissed off, you'll be decertified throughout the union. So there's 200 people in the union. You're going to accrue 300 people. They could call a certification election, and you're going to wind up with zero. That started to change their minds and started to, I think, cross people off of their list that they wanted to have in. Well, we got into really, that is UFAS, into a really pretty heated argument with the AFT state folks because of the strategy. I mean, they just saw, you know, the opportunity to just pick off thousands of people without going through the effort, cost, whatever. It's very costly to run a certification election, run a union campaign. I mean, you have to hire these people to be organizers and do all these mailings and convince people and this whole thing. Well, through this, you just have to hire a lawyer, basically. They do the petition, they go to the hearing and argue the case. And I said that that's, well, for many of the reasons that that's, we're going to wind up either without anything, because people will be so pissed, or if for some reason people don't decertify the union or vote no, we'll wind up with a very weak union. Because part of the process of organizing people and getting people engaged and building their union makes for a stronger union. And instead it was a formula for either a catastrophe or just a bad union. So they really compounded their problem. What they did then, and this was just unbelievable, most people still didn't know what was going on with this. It hadn't gotten much publicity at all, no press publicity. It had been operating at a pretty low level of discussion, mostly between us UFAS folks and AFT and FSME and so on. Well, what happened is someone had contacted a Journal Sentinel or some reporter to talk about this. AFT found out that there was going to be a newspaper report about it. Not that that many people in Madison read the Journal Sentinel, right? Well, their response was so over the top. They then, that day, sent out a letter to everybody on their list of all the potential accreted individuals. I wish I had a copy of it. It was, this is to notify you that you will be accrued to our union, and you will be a member based on, but it was very kind of legalistic letter to hundreds of people, and I don't know whether they said you will start paying dues or anything, but certainly that was there between the lines, and people just went nuts. People came into my office, you know, sort of waving their letter because they knew that I was active in the union, and they were, what does this mean? Aren't we supposed to vote on this? I mean, they sort of knew the 101s. You know, they saw the movie Norma Rae or whatever it is. You know, so what happened then? The administration said, well, this is a tremendous opportunity for us to protect our people against the union. I mean, a lot of people called HR and said, what's going on? HR said, well, I don't know what's going on. I mean, we're not responsible for this. I mean, they knew about the whole union clarification thing, but they were going to sort of stand aside and let the unions bash each other's over the head looking for this group and that group. Biddy Martin then sends out a letter. Biddy Martin's the new chancellor, newly appointed at that point. And she sends out a letter saying, we shall protect you. We will not allow these unions to just take away your rights to decide, to choose, you know, sort of those magic words, and just by legal fiat make your union members and force you to pay dues. And I still remember reading the letter on my computer saying, this is of like three worst cases. I hadn't even thought of this one, but this is the other worst case, is we now have pushed everybody into the protective arms of the administration, and there they'll be, and we're the bad guys. It was just incredible. I think the academic staff assembly then called a meeting about, you know, sort of an informational meeting about what's going on. I remember it was in the Armory building and Mugridge building, and their big hall there, you couldn't fit into it. It was so crowded. It was definitely the biggest gathering of academic staff ever, you know, and out of the whole group, only one person said that they were interested in being a member of the union. Everybody, I mean, people weren't all, you know, just vocally anti-union, most were. But only one person said, well, let me just say, I would like to join you. I don't like what the union did here, but I would like to, you know, join a union. So that was, we never, you know, got them to stop it. So what we did is we said, well, this is just untenable. They're destroying any possibility of having an academic staff union, and also potentially poisoning it for faculty as well. Because faculty knew about this. So we said the thing to do is to split off and sort of decertify ourselves as a have a union election. And we attempted to do that, and that was unsuccessful. You needed 2/3 of the membership.
Two-thirds to vote one way or the other?
Yeah, 2/3 to decertify, to join a different, start something else. So that didn't happen. And I and some other people left, and then by that point, Biddy Martin had started her discussion of this public-private partnership program, this new... This was before the 2010 election, so we were in 2010 then. But it was before the election. She met with Barrett and Walker to try to get them on board with, I think, was a not such a veiled attempt to split off the Madison campus. We would have a separate funding stream. We would have a different governance system of some kind. And she, I mean, you were on campus when Biddy was there. She was just a terrific salesperson on this, a really good politician. She gave talks around campus about it, you know, sort of selling the idea, and I went to two of them. They were almost all academic staff at these things, and I always sat in the front row because I wanted to watch what people's reactions were as she talked. And she always said the same thing about, because of the state personnel system and the classification system, the UW system is really encumbered from giving people the kinds of raises, you know, recognizing what those classifications were and giving people the kind of raises that they deserve. And that's the point where I always turn around and watch people. And you'd see a whole crowd of people individually, but collectively, nod their heads. Yes, she's talking about me. And we think that we should, you know, people deserve more money, especially those people who are working, in an unusual capacity or at some exceptional and outstanding capacity, and everybody would be shaking their heads that certainly I'm the one that she's really has in mind here. You know, we have, you know, sort of 95% of people thinking they're above average. So she worked that quite a bit, and all the other aspects of what might happen should we stand alone kind of faded. You know, I mean, people were not as, of course, interested in all as that, as the equity that they'll gain once, you know, we get our right to be free of this kind of substandard other campus partners. I mean, it really played a lot on the flagship talk, you know, and our sense of being exceptional, a international campus of renown. We're not like, you know, Platteville, you know, and we shouldn't be treated like Platteville and Oshkosh, you know, sort of the exceptionalism. Let me end it there. Yeah. I've got to run along.
Yep.
And
so, David, I want to thank you for your time today. Okay. Appreciate it.